loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we have two segments. In our first half hour, we will review the biggest news of the weekend, including the women's marches. And then today, we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. This is a segment that we air on Loud and Clear every Tuesday.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the government shutdown is now in its second month, and no solution appears in sight as the Trump administration digs in and refuses to budge from its demand for a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. The shutdown is beginning to have serious effects on the overall health of the economy. Next, Reporters Without Borders has condemned the continued detention in the United States of Marzia Hashemi, an American citizen who is a journalist for Iran's Press TV. Hashemi was detained on a material witness warrant to force her to testify before a federal grand jury. That testimony is supposed to take place today. Hashemi has been held in St. Louis and now in Washington since January 13th. Then the European Commission confirmed this morning that a no-deal Brexit would mean a hard border for Ireland. That is, the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland would be like crossing any other international frontier. But the soft border was one of the pillars of the Good Friday Accords that ended the decades-long war in the north of Ireland. Meanwhile, a second referendum that could see Brexit overturned is becoming increasingly possible. And then we continue our regular segment, which we do every Tuesday, called Women in Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. And finally, controversy continues to surround a BuzzFeed article saying that President Trump had specifically ordered his former attorney, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about the Trump Organization's plans to build a residential tower in Moscow in 2016. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team took the unusual step of denying the piece in an embarrassing rebuke to the publication and to the Russiagate narrative overall. And in other headlines, the Supreme Court ruled today that the Trump administration's ban on transgender people serving in the military can go into effect while the issue is taken up in the legal system. The order was announced by Trump in 2017 and issued in 2018. The court did not rule on the legality of the ban itself, however. The Israeli government has claimed responsibility for a series of airstrikes it carried out in Syria that it says targeted Iranian positions. Iran is a main ally of the Syrian government in that country's civil war. Israel frequently carries out these strikes in violation of Syrian sovereignty, but it's rare for them to publicly acknowledge the attacks. Ukraine's parliament is considering honoring as Hero of Ukraine Yaroslav Semenovich Stetsko. Stetsko endorsed the Holocaust's attempted genocide of the Jewish people. Iowa Senator Joni Ernst claimed that she was approached by Donald Trump during the 2016 campaign to be his vice presidential running mate. Ernst made the claim as part of a filing in a divorce proceeding. She was elected to the Senate in 2014. The Los Angeles Teachers Union and the Los Angeles School District announced that they had reached an agreement to end a massive strike that began last week. Details about the terms of the agreement are still emerging. Members of the Teachers Union will vote to ratify or reject the agreement tonight. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to a review of some of the big news stories from this last weekend. A lot happened over the weekend, including women's marches across the country. Despite many, many attacks against the women's march and especially its leadership, we also had Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday and a federal holiday, which was ironically highlighted by groups like Northrop Grumman and the FBI. And Special Counsel Robert Mueller called foul on a breathless Russiagate report from BuzzFeed last week. And meanwhile, the government shutdown continues. Workers will be losing a second paycheck starting this week. That's 800,000 federal employees and many, many more contractors. We'll discuss all of the news from this long weekend. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Ariel Gold. She is a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. And we're joined from New York by Ted Rawl, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rawl.com, R-A-L-L.com. Ariel, Ted, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Thank you. Again, there was a lot of news this weekend. Let's talk about the women's marches. There was a women's march here in Washington, D.C., but the marches were all over the country. I looked at the New York Times headline the next day, and of course, the New York Times, true to form, said, oh, women's marches smaller. Nonetheless, hundreds of thousands of people, no doubt, participated this weekend. Ariel Gold.
And it was 0 degrees outside, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, that was true. I went down to the Women's March on Saturday, and it was about zero. That's the way it felt. Anyway, Ariel Gold, what was your take?
Well, exactly what you said. It was 0 degrees. You can't compare what's really an anniversary march, right? The third march with the first march, which was in relation to Trump's inauguration. So I don't think there was any expectation that it was going to be giant. But the really exciting news for me about the Women's March was, there's a number of exciting things. But right around the time of the march, the Women's March came out with their 2019 agenda, policy recommendations, very, very specific. And right at the top of it, along with the right to health care, was legislative recommendations for ending war, and specifically calling for support for the War Powers Act to be revoked to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, and for legislation to end U.S. weapons sales to Saudi Arabia.
Ted Rall, give us your take.
Well, yeah, the attacks were kind of amazing, especially because Linda Sansour, who is the organizer who was under fire for not disavowing Louis Farrakhan for his alleged anti-Semitic remarks in the past, issued a statement deploring anti-Semitism. And so, you know, that should have put an end to the whole thing. But it's interesting to me that the media did support the women's marches of January 21st of 2017, and to a lesser extent last year, but those were characterized as just primarily, even though that wasn't really the case, as anti-Trump marches, and the media was behind that. But now that the women's march has become more progressive, or is as viewed as being perhaps more militant, having more of a defined agenda, and I'm not talking about the reality, I'm just talking about the way the media is framing it. Now the attacks are coming out, and we're seeing the traditional attempts to undermine the anything that sort of smells of leftism in American politics.
I think, Ariel, it's particularly egregious that this charge has been leveled against the organizers of the Women's March for being anti-Semitic. Now, they're not anti-Semitic. They're opponents of any kind of racism or bigotry or anti-Semitism. The entire story is generated because a couple of the leaders spoke at events with Louis Farrakhan and said things that were not attacking Louis Farrakhan. And so there was this new litmus test that was presented, especially by moderate pro-democratic leadership forces, that they had to disavow Louis Farrakhan, because anything that Louis Farrakhan may have said at some point that was interpreted as anti-Semitic, if they have any contact with or relationship with the Nation of Islam, then they themselves become painted with the paintbrush of anti-Semitism, the label of anti-Semitism. So it's kind of like a religious thing. It's like an article of faith. Same with any demonized or targeted entity. Whether you agree with the Nation of Islam or Louis Farrakhan or not, the Nation of Islam is a major factor in the black community. And to demand that these anti-racist organizers, who are, again, also opposed to anti-Semitism, officially announced their break from the Nation of Islam or Farrakhan or having any contact, it seems to me to be wrong. Because even if you don't want to agree with something that somebody else said, the idea that you have to sort of raise your hand or genuflect at the altar and say, I pledge that I'm not connected to or will not speak with, it seems like an egregious kind of form of thought control. Anyway, what's your take, Ariel?
I think that there were some mistakes made, and Jewish community was significantly hurt, and responsibility was taken for that by the Women's March. Really, really clear statements that said, we took too long to respond. We recognize that. We see our Jewish sisters and we care. And as you said, we oppose all forms of racism and strongly oppose anti-Semitism. But we know throughout history that when a grassroots movement is successful, first attempts are made to destroy that movement from the outside. And then if that doesn't work, attempts are made to break it apart from the inside. And that's really what we saw here. Because the thing is, even if those mistakes are made, these are growing pains. These are the ways that we learn from each other, that we grow in community, looking at various forms of oppression. And anti-Semitism is very much on the rise today and a very dangerous force. But this is how we grow and learn from each other and stand with each other. So then that was used as a way to divide and split apart a movement. What we saw that was incredibly inspiring is that in the midst of this, Jewish women of color, largely Black Jewish women, came out and said, "We are taking leadership here within Jewish progressive community, and we're asking you, our Jewish family, to show up and to support this march and to recognize all of these intersecting forms of racism and to recognize that while no anti-Semitism is acceptable, the statements that Louis Farrakhan has made are repulsive. This is not the real threat to Jews. The real threat to Jews, the real rise of anti-Semitism is coming from dog whistles from within our government. This is President Trump. This is the blatant support of white nationalism by Representative Steve King and more of the same. This is the threat."
Ted Rall, you know, I can remember vividly that I'm the national director of the Answer Coalition. We were leading mass marches against the then pending war, the invasion of Iraq. We were getting hundreds of thousands of people out literally month after month after month. At one point, there was a particular person within the Jewish community, a rabbi, who accused the Answer Coalition of being anti-Semites. Now, the right wing was accusing us of anti-Semitism all the time because we were supporting the Palestinian people's right to self-determination. And back then, just mentioning Palestine was so taboo that if you came out for Palestine, the pro-Israeli government forces labeled you as an anti-Semite. But this one rabbi who we didn't invite to speak at a particular demonstration in San Francisco called the Answer Coalition anti-Semitic. We had three other rabbis speaking at the same platform, and our coalition was completely 100% unanimously opposed to any kind of racism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. But then the Wall Street Journal picked up the story and made a big deal out of it and said these were the anti-war anti-Semites. And a whole lot of people who were supporters of the Answer Coalition, particularly from the Jewish community at that time, this was 2002, 2003, actually believed that we were anti-Semites because it was being echoed in the mainstream media. And it seems to me to be such a trick because, as Ariel Gold is saying, there is real anti-Semitism. It's dangerous. We saw what happened with the Holocaust, with World War II. We've seen it for centuries, the real problem of anti-Semitism. It comes from the right wing, the ultra-right. It comes from the powers that be. Again, now being used opportunistically to divide progressive movements.
Yeah, well, you said it's a trick. It's also a very effective trick. The conflation of being, for example, opposed to Israeli policy in the occupied territories and inside Israel, as well as conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism has been just an ongoing thing. And I can tell you, as a political cartoonist, I think twice before I draw a cartoon that's supportive of Palestinian rights, because I know that if I do, and when I do, and I do it sometimes, I will be accused of anti-Semitism, and that's a very uncomfortable place to be, and it's not true, and you know how it is in politics. If you're playing defense, you're losing. So I think lots of people feel that way. And frankly, the oppressed people of Palestine are not getting the level of support that they would get from American progressives if it weren't for the effectiveness, how effective this tactic is. And it really does work. And it's kind of gross and wildly intellectually dishonest, but it works.
Ariel, I'd like to turn to the commemorations that we saw yesterday for Martin Luther King, the Martin Luther King holiday. There were a couple, more than a couple, there were three that struck us as quite odd, and I'd like to get your take on it. The first was from Northrop Grumman, the
Merchant of Death.
Yes, famed defense contractor, the Merchant of Death, that manufactures Reaper drones that are then sold to the Saudis to kill Yemeni women and children. And they tweeted and Facebooked this. It's a photograph of the Martin Luther King Memorial here in Washington. And it says, sometimes a life's fulfillment is fulfillment of the lives of others.
Okay, that's Northrop Grumman. What about that's the CIA? Right. They were also on, you know.
The CIA did the same thing. A black and white photo of Martin Luther King at the Civil Rights March at the Lincoln Memorial, remembering the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
And the last one is the one I love the most because—
The best.
The FBI.
It's the FBI.
Maybe the assassins of King.
Yeah. At the very, very least, we know 100% factually that they had a clandestine operation to try to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide, right? And they tweeted here, today, on the anniversary of his assassination, the FBI honors the life, work, and commitment of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to justice.
Ariel Gold, members of the Martin Luther King family are calling for a reinvestigation of the King assassination because they want to find out whether the FBI actually killed Martin Luther King Jr. Anyway, I'm glad we're talking about this. Taking somebody who was a radical, a revolutionary, certainly somebody, a courageous fighter against the powers that be, and trying to turn him into a harmless icon by those same powers.
Well, it's hard not to laugh about all of this, except that it's really a serious thing. So along with that, I want to add that I believe it was Mike Pence who said that Trump's desire to build the wall is in the legacy of Martin Luther King.
Yes, he did indeed.
Oh, my God.
Because they're both agents of change, he said.
Oh, well, Hitler was an agent of change.
A big change.
I also watched all day. So we had, there was a fantastic op-ed published in the New York Times by Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow. I think it was something around, you know, we have to end the silence on Palestine. So it was a beautiful, beautiful op-ed. The Anti-Defamation League and the American Jewish Council came out, said that Michelle Alexander was appropriating Martin Luther King and that it was shameful. And then all day, pro-Israel forces, you know, went on again and again about how King had supported the Jewish state, which in fact he had. But that was quite a long time ago. And Michelle Alexander's op-ed went through and looked at his positions and where he likely would be today. And there is no question whether Dr. King would have supported the occupation of Palestine, would have supported merchants of death, would have supported the FBI and the actions that they still take today, and certainly not a border wall with Mexico.
Indeed. Michelle Alexander's op-ed really should be read by everybody. It's published on January 19th. It's called Time to Break the Silence on Palestine. Martin Luther King Jr. courageously spoke out about the Vietnam War. We must do the same when it comes to this grave injustice in our time. Again, she also, Ted Rall, talks about the Canary Mission using McCarthyite tactics of secret organizations, the Canary Mission being one of them, a covert operation to smear journalists and academics and clergy and activists. Anybody who dares boycott against Israel, which, as Michelle Alexander is pointing out, jeopardizes employment prospects and future careers, all designed to muzzle people. And when you think about it, Ted Rall, when Dr. King spoke out 1 year to the day before he was assassinated, April 4th, 1967, at Riverside Church to denounce the U.S. war in Vietnam, and that war was being led by Lyndon Johnson, the same advocate of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 64 and 65, such that Martin Luther King was actually denounced by many, not only right-wingers, but even those within the civil rights community for making the cause of the civil rights movement, which was so hard against so many odds, even more precarious because it seemed to be taking opposition to, it was taking opposition to a U.S. foreign policy position. Dr. King was a hero. He would undoubtedly today be standing with the Palestinian people.
Undoubtedly. Well, that's the thing is, we, of course, King's name has been sanitized. There's a national holiday that we just celebrated in his honor. But we're forgetting that by the time he was assassinated, his opposition to gangster capitalism and his pivoting toward discussing the issue of poverty and income inequality of the United States and also his opposition to the war, bringing him more into direct conflict with the powers that be and with the capitalist system overall, left him pretty alone from many of his traditional liberal and Democratic Party allies. And he was definitely far more isolated by 1968 than he had been earlier. And even though it's not to say that he didn't take tremendous risks as a civil rights leader, but when he pivoted to broader issues than just racial injustice, it definitely left him isolated. And, you know, that dynamic, I think, continues today.
Yeah. Ariel Gold, let's stay for another minute or so on this topic. Dr. King actually was a radical, I think, a long time before he was killed, but he was becoming more and more openly radical in his proclamations. In 1952, he wrote a letter to Coretta Scott King, or was Coretta Scott. She wasn't yet King. She wasn't yet married to Martin Luther King. He wrote in 1952, "I am much more socialistic in my economic theory than capitalistic. Today, capitalism has outlived its usefulness." That was 1952, in the middle of the witch hunt. But right before he was killed in 1967, he said these words. This is now out in the open, not a private letter. "One day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy." That's King the year before he's killed. Again, a sign of the times. The times were becoming more and more radical, and he was becoming more and more able to really be himself, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just want to give a shout out to the fact that we have brought his work back, the incredible Poor People's Campaign. And so this is, I think, the first year since they launched that we are here at Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. And you know, that we are, again, dealing with these issues of racism and the intersections between racism, capitalism, and militarism, because these issues cannot be separated from each other. If we're looking at Northrop Grumman, right, and their disgusting, you know, tweet yesterday, they're not just manufacturing the tools that kill the people of Yemen, that kill the people of Gaza, and so on, but they're also making billions of dollars and holding our economy hostage by doing so. So these are interconnected systems. And what Dr. King really brought to the surface and what made him so dangerous is that he saw these not as separate issues, but as things that are connected to each other and that we have to address simultaneously if we are to build a more peaceful and equitable world.
Ted Rawl, I want to switch topics real quick. We will spend a minute on this. We're going to do another segment about it later. BuzzFeed published an article at the end of last week that Donald Trump had ordered Michael Cohen, his personal lawyer, to lie to Congress about how long the Trump Organization was continuing its negotiations for a possible Trump Tower in Moscow. Directing somebody to lie to Congress would, of course, be certainly in the category of a high crime or misdemeanor and an impeachable offense. The media went very ballistic about it, proving, I think, or hoping to prove that this was, in fact, the smoking gun. But then Robert Mueller and the Mueller probe did the very, very unusual thing for them, which was to come out and speak. And what they said was, this story is not true. What was your take on all that?
This is going to be one of those, on the one hand, this, on the other hand, that kind of takeaways. On the one hand, I know one of the reporters who wrote the BuzzFeed piece, Jason Leopold, and I have the highest respect for him, and I would be very surprised if he made this up and it wasn't well sourced. Now that said, I've been surprised in the past, and that you know, by other things, so it's anything's possible. But it would be a shock for me. I mean, he's a very legit guy and a very hardworking, aggressive journalist. On the other hand, then there's the The statement put out by Mueller's office is unusual and seems like as close to a categorical denial as you're ever going to get from a government agency. But then on the other hand, who can trust what Robert Mueller has to say? He hasn't presented any evidence whatsoever.
One thing is that Jason Leopold has gotten several stories on the Russia story wrong. I can remember about a year ago in 2017, he reported again with these kind of big headlines, and it was treated similarly by the media, that Russia had sent $30,000, that they had a report, a cable from the Russian government to the Russian, from the Russian foreign ministry to the Russian embassy saying, here's $30,000 for the 2016 election. Jason Leopold reported that this proved that Russia was interfering in the Trump campaign to collude with Trump to make sure that Trump would become president, except the money was for the Russian election, which was taking place at the same time, and Russian embassies allowed Russian citizens to participate in the election. In other words, wanting to get ahead of the story, to have that breaking news, to show finally here's the smoking gun. And it turned out to be completely false, although the media picked it up as it picked up this story last week and said this will be the final denouement for Trump. Again, we're not friends of Trump, but I don't see what Robert Mueller's incentive would be to deny this explosive allegation against Donald Trump, except for the fact that it's not true and Mueller knows it's not true. But Jason Leopold has also gotten not just this story wrong, and I believe it will be proved to be wrong. He has three other stories during the entire Russiagate probe that also turned out to be not true. Ariel Gold, going back to the weekend, we now are hearing reports that the teachers in Los Angeles may have settled their strike. We don't know all the details yet. The rank and file hasn't ratified it. But when you look at Los Angeles after West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, there is a revival of the U.S. labor movement, it seems, and it's largely led by women and it's largely led by educators. Pretty important.
Well, let's give some credit to the Women's March, right? This has been an incredible rising of women that we've seen in the past couple of years. And teachers, this is long overdue, right? As we watch this continued bloated military budget, as we are about to retrofit our nuclear arsenal, teachers continue to need to hold two or three jobs to support themselves. This is long overdue, and I hope that the teachers have a fantastic deal worked out. And let's get some labor rights for all of these people, that all these federal workers who, after 31 days it is now, are still without pay.
Yep, I hear you. And again, put out of work or working without pay for a completely bogus reason presented by Donald Trump, purely political opportunism. We're out of time. We were joined from Washington, D.C. by Ariel Gold. Ariel is a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. And we were joined from New York by Ted Rawl, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rawl.com. That's RALL.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series. We do this every Tuesday called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Where to begin? Davos, the center, the mecca of globalization. Go ahead.
Yeah, let's talk about Davos. So Davos is a place in Switzerland. It's a very high-end ski resort that very wealthy people take their families to vacation. And every year, the World Economic Forum holds its annual conference there. And what is the World Economic Forum? Well, it is hundreds of heads of state, so presidents, prime ministers, and the like, meet with, quotes, business leaders, which you can read as billionaires. The ultra-wealthy attend this conference. And the ultra-wealthy get restricted access to heads of state all over the world to help them understand what they need from them, what sort of policies they want them to interact. what kind of issues they're dealing with so that the heads of state can help make things easier for them. They get an access to these world leaders in a way that their citizens almost never do. And basically, it's a forum where the ultra wealthy and the kind of various state rulers determine the course of history and determine what direction the economy is going to move in, what sort of things they're concerned about, and what actions they're going to take to protect the very wealthy's interest, and generally network with one another. It's not very well known by most people. I mean, it gets written about and published about, so it's not super secretive, but the vast majority of your average citizens aren't really aware of this meeting because, of course, it's so completely out of touch with their day-to-day lives. And really, it's, you know, an opportunity for them to kind of plan the future for the ultra wealthy to ensure that their needs are being met in the ages to come. This particular meeting was of particular interest because there was a number of very unique challenges and changes to it that I kind of want to discuss and unpack. But first, I just want to talk a little bit about the billionaires there, because, as you know, CNN reports, the top 26 billionaires own $1.4 trillion, which is as much as 3.8 billion people on planet Earth. So almost 4 billion people. So 26 people own almost as much as 4 billion people in the US. And in the last 10 years, ever since the financial crisis, the number of billionaires and their net worth has increased dramatically. There are more billionaires now, a record 2,208, than there ever have been in history. And their wealth has grown exponentially. They earn on average $2.5 billion every day. So every day they get $2.5 billion, while the rest of the world, and especially the poorest half of the global population, has seen their net worth dwindle. Everyone's wages have either stagnated or have gone down. So since 2008 and the financial crisis that almost wiped us out, the wealthy are doing very, very well. Have made a tremendous gains, while the rest of us have seen little to no gains, or in fact, net losses overall.
Daniel, I got to ask you too. You know, there's a lot of press about Davos every year. This goes way back to I guess Bill Clinton was one of the early regulars at Davos. But then it leads me to question, who cares? What actually gets done when all these rich people get together and think the big thoughts? They don't necessarily go back and implement any of these programs, do they? They just get together and talk and drink expensive champagne and then go home.
Well, there is some of that, but no, I think that these networkings are extremely important, because what happens is not necessarily what CNN's going to cover. There's many, many conversations that are off the record and not directly to the press. And the point is, the billionaires want the heads of state to understand what you're going to need to do to keep my money flowing into your nation, or to keep me from perhaps moving business operations out of your nation into other places and hurting your economy, because they most certainly can. And so a lot of it is them talking, oh, these taxes or these particular regulations are really challenging for me. If there's anything you could do that would really help me out, I'd love to bring more economic growth to your nation, et cetera. So it's not just smoke and mirrors. I think it's also a really potent symbol for the partnership, the deep cemented connection between the ultra wealthy and the heads of state, which are supposed to be disconnected, right? The elected leaders are supposed to be responsible to the people and not responsible to wealth, and they have to address the needs of the many, the majority. When in fact, what Davos shows is that it's quite the opposite. They get to have special forums. I mean, imagine if, you know, grade school teachers got to have a special meeting in Davos, Switzerland with elected leaders, or I don't know, educators across the world, or factory workers or sanitation workers, right? Where they could express their needs and concerns, what they're worried about, what their families are struggling with, what they need help with. Nothing like this exists, of course, but it certainly exists for them. So I think it's not just smoke and mirrors. I think it's not just a symbol. It is a potent reminder of the unity between these two supposedly disconnected but not actually groups of people. I think also what's really interesting this year is typically this, you know, forum is headed by the kind of Western powers, so in Europe and especially the United States. Donald Trump has missed it this year and last year because mainly of his sort of opposition to globalization, this kind of new sort of ultra-nationalism that he's trying to install. So it's kind of thumbing his nose at the global elites. But also France is sitting it out, and so is Theresa May in the United Kingdom. So Macron in France and Theresa May. And that's largely due to the fact of the massive unrest in their countries, especially in France. I mean, France is almost in like a pre-revolutionary situation, as for the last few months, people have been protesting by the millions in the streets. And then, of course, the United Kingdom is in chaos because the Brexit deal is falling apart, and they're starting to realize how interconnected their economies are globally and how wildly unpopular Theresa May's government is. And then, of course, you could really say the same thing about Trump. His administration is wildly unpopular, hated by many millions of people, does not enjoy popular support, has a dedicated base, to be sure, but is one of the most divisive administrations in U.S. history. So what's interesting about this is it shows a lot of the Western kind of traditional powers are sitting this one out because of how the political situation is at home, which means at Davos, there's actually going to be a lot more focus this year on non-Western nations who are attending them, which may signal a shift in the kind of global balance of power. But I think it's a really important thing to point out because that is unusual for Davos. That does not usually happen.
It'll probably be a better meeting. I mean, America not there, UK, France, the dominant imperial colonial powers, the powers that bomb Libya, the dominant powers in the developing world, not there, at least their heads of state. You know, I want to talk about this issue of income inequality and just sort of put it into some perspective. So here we have a changing economic climate. Again, the outsized gains of billionaires. The billionaires who Daniel talked about, their fortunes rose by 12% in the last year, 12%. Now, for the bottom half of the population of the planet, that's the 3.8 billion people that these 26 individual billionaires have the equivalent wealth of, that part of the population, their net wealth decreased by 11%, right? So the billionaires, their income went up 12%. Their income, these 26 people, equal to the wealth of 3.8 billion poor people. And the poor people's wealth went down by almost the same amount. Now, if you think back to the issue of income inequality, it was a big issue in the 2016 election here because of Bernie Sanders. The yellow vest movement, that's an indication of the struggle around income inequality. The rise of Jeremy Corbyn as the leader of the Labor Party. Jeremy Corbyn, a socialist, a long time, you know, his whole life has been dedicated to the cause of working people. It's not a new issue either. You think about Karl Marx. Again, for socialists, Karl Marx, people go back to Karl Marx. And even the Wall Street Journal, every once in a while, they'll write an article about Karl Marx was right. Now, Karl Marx wrote the book, Wage, Labor, and Capital. It's a small pamphlet, or Value, Price, and Profit, or Critique of Political Economy, or all three volumes of Capital. And he's talking about the sort of motor force or the inner laws of capitalism that lead to income inequality. Marx, in the book, in the pamphlet, Wage, Labor, and Capital, said capitalism means the immiseration of poverty on one side and the accumulation of wealth on the other, meaning that they happen in tandem. And if you go through all of those in deep, sort of insightful, analytical works, there's a lot to learn. But when you boil it right down, the reason there are so many poor people in the world is that a few rich people have all the money. I mean, when 26 people have the accumulated wealth equal to 3.8 billion poor people, the reason poor people don't have money is all the money's with the rich people. And money, there's a finite amount of wealth, and it's all accumulated at one pole. Anyway, go ahead.
That's extremely important. And I think there's also kind of a snowball effect with this, because one of the things, you know, you'll read in sort of mainstream media when they, because even they are forced to acknowledge this global inequality, even they who are run and owned by billionaires who really rather not talk about it are forced to at least acknowledge it and at least confront it. And one of the things they talk a lot about is policy. They talk about taxation. They say we need more progressive taxes. We don't have progressive taxes. And that's why these wealthy people control everything. But really, I think that that is kind of a misnomer. The snowball effect that I'm referring to is the fact that as this wealth grows at the other end of the pole, the institutional power that they have, of which Davos is just one small example, continues to grow as well. And what they're going to ensure is that policies are put in place that protect their interests. And certainly raising taxes is not one of their interests. So one of the problems is you know, under this current economic system, and especially under the system of government, which favors the ultra wealthy, there is not an outlet for those progressive changes. There's not an opportunity for, you know, Jeff Bezos to get taxed what he owes, or Bill Gates or something like that, so that the 3.8 million people don't live in poverty. There is a need for a fundamental change of system that confronts what is wildly unethical. I mean, morally repugnant that people should own this much money at the expense of so many. And that's really the important point, is they're not rich because they're smart. They're not rich because they work harder than all the 3.8 billion people, or they're more deserving. They're rich because the 3.8 billion people go without, and they get to have because other people don't. That's a really important part to raise as well. So what we need to start discussing and what we need to start addressing is how that income is distributed. Because right now, under capitalism, which allows people to own private property and accumulate without limit, without restriction, what you have is, over a period of time, ever since Marx wrote, it's been about 150 years, maybe a little longer, we've seen this massive increase in wealth. I mean, the wealth that Marx decried was pretty brutal back then, and the poverty was brutal as well, but it was nothing compared to the sort of extremes we see today. The extremes have only grown more pronounced. I think of any environment where it's a area of great wealth, like San Francisco, right? You have all these tech companies that are making money hand over fist, and people are flocking to San Francisco to participate in that wealth. But on the other end, you have rampant, out of control homelessness throughout the city, where total destitution and poverty is literally on every street corner. I mean, you literally walk by it on a constant basis. And why is that? Well, the reason why tech industry is able to have the tremendous wealth it has and the outside influence is because of the immiseration of other people, is because other people are forced to go without and live in tent cities and live on street corners, et cetera. So that's a really important thing to address, because as this situation becomes more extreme, as billionaires continue to accumulate this, it becomes that much more difficult for anything, even moderate progressive tax reforms, to go into law. And it really requires systemic change and not just kind of a tweaking of the regulations that we have now.
Daniel, let's go on to our next story. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of in that vein, what Davos has been talking a lot about is the global slowdown, because what the billionaires and the economists are predicting and already kind of seeing the starts of is a global slowdown. So it looks like we're in 2019, the United States will very likely enter some kind of recession, and that will in turn impact the rest of the world. I mean, as you know, when we had the 2008 crisis, the rest of the world, as bad as it was for us, the rest of the world, it was even worse. I mean, Europe is kind of splintering and fracturing apart with wildly high unemployment rates, and that's largely a downstream effect of the 2008 crisis. Latin America, too, has serious economic consequences because of the economic fallout here. So what it looks like is we're progressing more toward some kind of global slowdown, at least around 2019, although perhaps longer. They talk a lot about China, who's also seeing a global slowdown due to the tariffs largely and the kind of U.S. sanctions that they're putting against that country. Although it's also just kind of a natural part of the capitalist cycle that is seeing that downturn in it. That being said, I mean, China's growth is still about twice what ours is, twice and a half. So let's put it in perspective, because you'll read the Wall Street Journal and they like to crow about how China's growth rate is slowing down. And technically that's true, but it's still way higher than the United States by a long shot. But we're also seeing that slowdown here in the United States. And this is, you know, an extremely politically charged time. The global income inequality, as we just discussed, is impacting these social movements, like with Jeremy Corbyn or the Yellow Vests or the Bernie Sanders movement or the many other social movements we're seeing out the world. And this global slowdown, I think, will aggravate it. You know, what's the old expression? People are three missed meals away from revolution, I think is the saying. And I think we will see more of that. I think we will see more of an aggressive polarization of society, a more radicalism as the situation becomes more desperate. I mean, over the last 10 years, we saw a lot of economic expansion for the ultra wealthy, which, you know, indirectly did impact working people some, although most wages were mostly stagnant. If we start seeing a downturn where working people are just barely recovering from 2008 and many are not recovered at all, we're going to see some serious fallout from that. And that's really what they're predicting is happening. I mean, the general consensus amongst economists and kind of those that are paid millions of dollars to study this stuff is that we're going to see a global slowdown throughout 2019 and that will actually become more aggregated in 2020, which definitely seems likely, especially given the new posture the United States has taken against kind of longtime allies, designating new enemies such as China and Russia. imposing more tariffs on them now that they have a very integrated economy. So I tend to agree. I don't see any reason why we wouldn't continue to see the slowdown unless there's some kind of radical change in direction.
Daniel, I want to talk about the American economy for a couple of minutes, especially as it pertains to some of these very old, longtime legacy companies like Sears and JCPenney. You know, it's not unusual for companies that have been around for 100 or 150 years to go out of business. I think we're probably seeing the beginning of the demise of General Electric right now, for example. But everybody at one point or another has shopped at Sears. Everybody at one point or another has shopped at JCPenney. I will admit that I bought a set of dishes there just 2 weeks ago, but it looks like they're circling the drain. Is that necessarily a bad thing? Is that just the new economy? Or can or should these companies be saved?
Yeah, so it's definitely a bad thing for a number of reasons. First of all, it's any sort of giants like this in the economy that are going down is going to create a lot of uncertainty and instability. So a lot of, you know, investors are going to wonder, wow, if we can't rely on these huge longtime companies, what can we rely on? And you're going to see a lot more volatility and panic in the market, the likes of which we saw in December. But more than that, what you're seeing is a shift in production, a shift in how things are made and purchased. And companies like JCPenney or Sears largely depended on big retail storefronts where they offered just about everything you could imagine, and people would drive up, buy what they needed there, and then go home. And that was really fundamental to their business. What we're seeing now is the kind of online shopping phase of things where it's not common to do that anymore. People purchase things online for delivery at their homes, and they don't actually go to those storefronts. Now, big businesses like Amazon really like this, right? Because the human capital required to fulfill those things is much lower. You need to staff a retail store, right? You need to have a whole bunch of workers out there stocking shelves, taking payments, working with customers. Online, you need a fraction of the amount of work. So, you know, for the very rich who have kind of bet on the tech companies, they're excited about this because it's much cheaper. But what it's going to have is a lot of longer term social costs because the workers are also the consumers. So if workers are being laid off because you don't need workers to run the Amazon.com storefront, right? And they're not able to get jobs, or they're not able to get as good a jobs, or they're having their wages ground down because they have less options to go to, you're also going to see less consumers, less people buying, because that's simply how the equation works. The less you pay the workers, the less they have to buy the stuff you're selling, and the less money you're going to make. This is going to have dramatic consequences down the line. I'm not exactly sure how this shift will shake out. You know, my crystal ball is no clearer than anyone else's, but it is going to result in a lot more poverty and economic instability now that we're shifting to a really kind of online giant warehouse situation, which requires a lot less workers than retail.
Yeah, and will continue to require fewer and fewer workers the way automation is progressing, I fear at least.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, there's a lot of drone delivery systems that are being implemented that are to work in the warehouses, that are to deliver packages. So that's going to eliminate, you know, FedEx workers or UPS workers who are delivering packages. We're definitely seeing a significant shift that's going to have a lot of really negative downstream effects for workers.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, where we take a look every week at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. We have a number of other big stories, and we only have 10 minutes, so let's just spend about 1 minute on this one. But, you know, the stock market went up last week. It went up a lot, and it said all of the losses that were accumulated for 2018 were overcome in that 1 week. As we're pre-recording this show for today's segment, which airs at 4:30 East Coast time, we're talking to you right before that, a few hours before that. The stock market is down today so far. Maybe it'll go up by the time the show is on the air. It's down 293 points. But then I look at the headlines from the past 24 hours on the Wall Street Journal. Here they are. China annual economic growth rate is slowest since 1990. World, second one. World braces for slower growth. Third, IMF lowers 2019 global growth forecast. A major market's major headache, stocks that crash without warning. Next one, investors' best option, keep faith in U.S. stocks. Next one, how China's growth slowdown could rattle stocks around the world. I mean, the headlines, when you look at them, there's no logic, there's no rationale. They're up, they're down, it's slowing.
It's like there's no linear way of analyzing this thing.
Yeah, and again, it seems as if we're the entire world, including all of its inhabitants, have just entered this big casino We have a couple hundred dollars in our pocket. We want to have small wagers so we don't lose it all at once. But nobody knows by the end of the day, are we going to go up? Are we going to go down? Why this kind of toxic volatility?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's this casino style, right? We don't plan our economy. We have it anarchistically. So people are allowed to invest, put money in, take money out at will, provided they, you know, own that money. The instability is really coming around this grand experiment, which is what would happen if we tariffed all our allies and we applied tariffs on China and all these essential trading partners? What if we tore up NAFTA and redid it under totally new terms? What if we basically just tried to smash the current economic order and not replace it with any clear vision of what is supposed to take its place, how money is supposed to be distributed now, how business is supposed to run. And that's basically the kind of experiment that the United States is engaged in. And that's creating tremendous chaos. What you're seeing with the Wall Street Journal, though, is clearly they're lining up on the side of the United States. No big surprise there. And all their articles are about how China's slowing down. Oh, no, China. China's having trouble. Look out, China. But the truth is, China's growth rate is still over 6%, which, just to give you a comparison, the United States is trying to get at 3%. And that's what Trump wanted to promise, you know, 3%, which was a big deal, right, when he was promising that. That's a lot of money. And so it's, you know, it's still double what we have. So trying to act like somehow it's, you know, weaker or that investors aren't interested in it is ridiculous. If you're an investor and you can make 3% or you can make 6%, do the math, you're going to go with 6%. So that's a lot of kind of, you know, ideological propaganda from the Wall Street Journal, which wants to say, you know, America first, buy American stocks, because, of course, that's their primary investors. That's their primary advertisers. They're going to want to make sure that they're protecting their interests. But the truth is that we are seeing some fundamental shifts from the West to the East, whether it's Davos, all the Western powers sitting it out, the United States realizing that China's not just going to roll over, that it's not this weak sort of paper tiger, that it can actually stand up for itself and it has some real power. And that's creating tremendous volatility and instability in the markets. So we don't know. We don't know. It's like a casino, like you said. Brian, do you know if you're going to roll a 7 at the craps table or if it's going to be snake eyes? Hard to tell until you've rolled it. And the Wall Street Journal is getting paid a lot of money to sort of speculate on whether it's going to be a 7 or a 2. We won't know until the dice land.
Daniel, if the Chinese economy is growing at such a healthy clip still, why are people talking about a slowdown in economic growth in China causing a global recession? Do they mean that if it slows down to 4%, 3%, 2%, the world goes into recession? Or is there a danger of that growth turning around and becoming a shrinkage?
Yeah. So the reason why they're talking about it is China's growth rate used to be significantly higher. So we're looking at like the 8 and the 9%. So it has gone down, no doubt about it. And the tariffs have absolutely been part of it. All these kind of wild attacks that the United States is making on China absolutely are impacting it, no doubt about it. So that's why, you know, investors are saying, oh, hey, I used to get 9%. Now I'm getting 6%. That makes me feel pretty bad. But I also want to put it in the context of kind of global growth overall. That growth rate is still quite healthy. That growth rate is still quite good. Income inequality is starting to become more of a challenge in China as the middle class have really risen up. Xi Jinping talked about income inequality being the number one biggest problem that he's seeking to tackle the last party Congress. So there's a huge acknowledgement of that. And that is something new that China is now having to grapple with as they kind of did this kind of socialist, capitalist, very complex blended economy. So it is seeing its own transformations and its own struggles there. But I think what I want to just drive home in this segment is that we need to put that in perspective. You know, the government there still enjoys tremendous support. There is still a tremendously strong public sector that has huge influence in the country. There is still a high growth rate. And a lot of the problems that we struggle with, you know, in the United States, they don't necessarily struggle with, at least not certainly the same way. So let's just put it in context. It's not, you know, China's going down and we're going up. It's actually quite different than that.
There's another interesting element of it as well. China opened up starting in 1978. That's what they call it, opening up, meaning that foreign companies could directly invest in China, either as joint partnerships with Chinese companies or Chinese state-owned companies, whatever. There was a lot of direct investment. Now, before 1978, there was no investment or virtually no investment in China. There was no China market for Western goods. When you think about it in the long term, this is just 40 years since China opened up. The problem with the American capitalist economy or the Western capitalist economies is not the problem of shortage. It's the problem of surplus.
Yeah.
They have to sell products that have been made or capital that's been accumulated. It has to be invested somewhere. It's the problem of surplus. It's the problem of a glut. And people get laid off and factories close if too much has been produced than can be sold for at a profit. Here we have China, again, 40 years ago, wasn't part of the world market, the world capitalist market. It seems now that the outcome in China, whether China buys more goods, produces more goods, can take more direct foreign investment, the outcome there makes the entire world economy kind of contingent on what does happen in China. So that if China is still, while growing strong, slows, it could have an impact on the global capitalist economy. It shows a fragility inside that world economy.
That's a really important point, because what it also shows is how significant China is, how dependent other countries are on that exporting and that stimulation of the economy, and also how unpopular then this sort of trade war that Trump is engaged in is on a global level, because it's impacting a lot of people and a lot of people with money, many of which, for example, are at Davos as we speak. So that's a really important thing to point out, that, you know, in the 50s, China was a largely rural agrarian society. I mean, people, underwent famines because there would be a flood or a drought or something because they were so dependent on the land and technologically unadvanced. But then since then, there's been a tremendous transformation in society in China. And it is a modern industrial power with a very strong middle class with lots of disposable income. So it is not this kind of backward nation that the United States seems to think it is. You know, we're still stuck in this vision of it in the 50s or 70s. Now it's a real economic power, and now other countries want access to it, and other countries want to see it do well because its success is dependent on theirs. The United States doesn't seem to understand that. The United States is running off this extremely ideologically divisive view, which is that China is just the enemy and we have to do everything we can to hurt it, because, of course, there are many in the billionaire class here in the United States that believe that China is an economic rival to the United States, and they are more or less correct. China is growing in strength and power to a degree that we are not, and there may be an eclipsing at some point in the future, and I think a lot of them are desperately trying right now to sabotage that, to keep that from happening, where China's rise and our fall puts it in a superior position or an equal position. Because if there's one thing the United States hates, it's other countries on equal footing or superior footing than the United States, and it will do everything it can to try to prevent that from happening.
That was the voice of Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us every Tuesday in this segment on Loud and Clear called A Weekly Look at Wall Street and Corporate Capitalism. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. We talked to him from the San Francisco area. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.